Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who promises you unlimited suet pudding. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm a curious amoeboid with oddly grafted features. For
this one. Just what you'd expect to find in 1963 Shoreditch, it's Remembrance of the Daleks.
Can I just be Pamela Sailor?
I'd like to start this episode with a correction from a friend of the podcast. I do apologise, I've looked through Twitter and I can't find the original tweet, but it turns out that Doctor Who last season did not go up against Coronation Street. It went out on Mondays in the UK, but this year it is going up against Coronation Street.
Really?
Yeah.
That's against all Lawrence Miles and Tatwood received wisdom.
Yes, I know.
Perish that those two would never make an error.
Rocks the faction paradox to its foundations. I think it's also a good time to mention Jodie Bleeding Whittaker, gentlemen.
How exciting. I'm terribly excited.
Is that her middle name? I thought it was David. Or Davo to her mates.
Yes.
Poor Ian Levine. I don't think there's a lot to be said about Ian Levine. Jodie Whittaker's been and gone now. We're done. We've said everything.
My friend Drew, I'm not sure if she listens to the podcast, but she put up a wonderful imagined conversation between the various doctors. The first doctor just says, "What are you talking about, change? Who are all you people?"
Well, I mean, that is exactly the point. People keep talking about the Doctor being a shape-shifting alien, which I just think is kind of ridiculous. It's just a person who gets recast every few years. The idea that there's
no one's told him.
There's some sensible in-universe reason for it is just absurd. They don't invent regeneration until, well and truly into the 1970s after it's kind of happened twice. And it's just a way of getting rid of Bill Hartnell and casting Pat Troughton. There's nothing sort of really.
And then a woman.
Then a woman
if
person.
I was going to say Tom Baker, but no. If you're the lovely founder of our lovely program, David Williams / Sydney Newman.
Yes, that's right.
I wonder, that's an interesting combination for a fiction effort, isn't it? Slash fiction with Sydney Newman.
The funny thing is
she can come back as a woman. I think for this podcast, sorry to block you off, that we need to celebrate the introduction of Jodie Whittaker by supposing what would other characters be like. I would like to recast the Nemesis as Brian Blessed, and both as Lady Painful. Night of my life, fire of my loins. I want to see that. Have you never wondered who he is? I'm 57 and I shag everything for Venus. You know, he said that to the Dalai Lama. We've all been discussing it this week. I'm 57, I can't keep it in. The statue's alive.
Look, I'm...
Oh, Jodie.
The thing is, I'm in the, I think, wonderful situation of I've never seen Jodie Whittaker in anything.
I saw her last night and hardly noticed her. She's in Titanic / Dunkirk.
Oh, right.
Whatever. She's a Geordie, isn't she? Or is she just Northern?
She does a Northern accent in a film
she
called...
is actually Northern. Okay, I've seen her interviewed on A Breakfast Prog. She's Gracie Fields. We're going to be hearing "Biggest Aspidistra in the World" or the universe sung out loud.
Well, she does that accent in Adult Life Skills, but I watched her in Attack the Block last night, and I thought that was really fun. That might be my pick of the week later. And
yes,
and she's just doing a sort of standard sort of London accent.
Niceness accent.
Yeah.
But I'm actually more concerned. This is, and honest to goodness, I'm more concerned. I'm so bloody relieved at the casting. It's 8 years too late. We've all thought it and said it. It does feel like a drastic repitch for falling ratings, but it's about bloody time. But my real concern is, what's she going to do with the accent? I really am. I really got, Russell said it. I don't want to hear us rattling around the Midlands.
Yeah. Well, we've just had a Scottish accent. I think probably they'll go traditional.
I hope so. I'm looking to do Lumley.
Oh, like a super posh accent.
Well, because, it's canon now.
Yeah, yes. The 13th Doctor's a woman again. Yeah.
That was a raised eyebrow from radio.
But I haven't seen her in anything, and I'm actually kind of determined not to, because with Matt Smith,
You're not going to watch. You and Ian Levine, you're refusing to watch. You're never going to see her.
I'm going to see the program, but Matt Smith and Christopher Eccleston, I'd never seen in anything before I watched them in Doctor Who. So I came to Doctor Who without expectations, whereas Peter Capaldi, I was familiar with, for, you know, he did an early Poirot, he did guest spots in lots of things, he did the thick of it. I was familiar with all that.
He texted Brendan personally with vile Scottish insults.
I wish. Whenever I see him interviewed, he just seems so lovely. I think I've told the story where I almost literally ran into him in Covent Garden when I was living there in lush.
I know, I'm waiting for the euphemism as well, listener. We're right there. You didn't even have to pause and draw breath, did you?
I was bounding down a flight of stairs. He was coming up. Even though I almost ran into him, he stood off to one side and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, please."
Wow.
And, please, you know, would you care to share my bath?
Given that he was only Malcolm Tucker at the time, I fully expected to be given some instructions on how to do impossible things to my anatomy in a Scottish accent. And
if you have suggestions for impossible things to his anatomy, please do write in on a piece of soap.
But, you know, I thought to myself, oh, I should go off and watch Broadchurch, and I should watch Attack the Block, and I should watch all these things she's in. And then I thought, no, wait, and have the first thing you see Jodie Whittaker in be Doctor Who. So it's a matter of, you know, if Rod suddenly said to me, oh, I fancy watching Broadchurch, I'd watch it, but I'm not going to go out of my way to watch anything Jodie Whittaker. I want to come to her completely fresh.
It's a long time to wait, though.
Bring back the Doctor, don't hesitate. Yeah, have you seen that people on Twitter have started writing Doctor in a dress? Doctor in a dress. He's a doctor, not a doctoress. Doctor in a dress. Bring back his cock, we won't take less.
Should we have a little Delphic bay leaf chewing moment, oracle moment, and say what we feel is going to happen with the show? Is that correct, appropriate thing, do this?
I think my favourite Daily Mash headline has been, first Doctor Who story with Jodie Whittaker will just be men telling her how time travel works. I think a wonderful way to do it would be if we do, say, get some returning characters, maybe Kate and Osgood, and if they do react differently to the Doctor, who then uses that as a point to make, no, you don't have to react differently because I'm a woman. I'm still the same person. I'm still the Doctor.
I think Kate would say, you've based yourself on me.
Not only that, but remember, Bill's last words that the Doctor heard were, you know how I'm into girls and people around my own age. I'm glad you know that. Mm.
I thought he said stay warm. That bit ended on the cutting room floor, didn't it? Dirty old bugger.
Because that's the thing. I think they are going to address the change in gender somehow in the dialogue and in the narrative.
You've hit it right there. It's actually Bill. And you say that, I just think, William Hartnell said that. yes. Not really. I still hear that as William Hartnell.
Yeah, of course.
And he could carry it off too. Yeah, no, that's why. Just I don't mind that there's an excuse or there's a reason that he picks up faces and that he picks up accents in the same way. It's the only way to excuse David Tennant.
Well, I mean, I'm more interested in seeing what Chris Chibnall's going to do because I
kill it, obviously.
Yeah, I don't think he's that good a writer, but he's
exit wounds, cyber woman person, yeah,
but terrible. Also the power of three.
Yeah, the power of three is pretty good.
Yeah, but how much of that was Moffat fingering with his finger of Omega, Moffat slash?
It seemed a step above the stuff Moffat was doing that year, I have to say.
I really like power of three too.
Yeah.
It was homey again. It had people that we liked.
Yeah. Actually, that's what I want to see. Whoever the companion is, and I think they are going to go for a male primary companion, they may also bring in a female companion. But
and Gillian, yes.
Yeah, whoever the companion
picks them up
is,
with Billy, yeah.
I want them to have a family again.
Yes.
And really good legs.
Yeah,
he a young Jamie type in a frock.
He could wear skimpy clothes and be hot and ask dumb questions. What's happening, Doctor? That'd be awesome.
Let's bring back Jeff from the 11th Hour.
Yes. Yeah, why not?
The one with the laptop.
Yes. She'll remember that too. She'll dash right back. Have words.
Didn't I tell you to get a girlfriend, Jeff? Jump in my box. Well, we're about 3 hours into our discussion.
Hello,
Jodie Whittaker.
You're still there.
So,
hello.
Remembrance of the Daleks. First story with Ben Aronovich. as a writer.
Have you read his other stuff? I really like his London plodder books. Have you read those?
No, like Rivers of London and things.
It'll be Rivers of London. It's a great speech in Parliament by Sir Ian Benaranovich Paisley. No, they're really good. It's kind of like, you know, it's a slight psychic and woo-woo stuff, but it's a crossover. And it's very 70s, 80s TV cop show with Doctor Who mashed up in it.
Right. Mm. Well, the novelization was amazing. Remember that?
It is the best Target novelization.
Mm. I think it
ever.
Well, it has. I think the New Adventures owe a lot to it.
Yeah,
I
it
think,
wouldn't have come about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, not that I think it's a direct influence by any means, but if you haven't read, say, the novelization of Remembrance of the Daleks, and I should mention, we're about the fifth Australian podcast doing a Remembrance of the Daleks episode this month.
No.
Like, New to Who's done one. I think Crinoid podcast has done one in the UK. Just serendipity that all these people are doing those. But I was going to say
never heard of any of these people.
But Game of Thrones
is doing a podcast on Remembrance.
Is doing a podcast on Remembrance of the Daleks because the books are told, each chapter is from the perspective of a different character. So instead of having chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, you've got Arya 1 and then a few other people and then Arya 2 and then a few other people, Arya 3.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
It's the way Christopher Nolan makes films, and the new Dunkirk one is the same thing. He's done many before, and he talks about it as time comparisons. But yes, you reshoot the scene from a different perspective. It's confusing for a viewer, but as the narrative goes on, you feel even more drawn in. Well, that's the idea. You either do that or you're not off.
Well, it really works in this novelization of this story because we are constantly shifting characters and we're getting some insight into them. And it just shows how much thought Ben Aronovich put into his characters because, as explored, getting ahead of ourselves, later in the Countermeasures spin-off, which features characters from this, Professor Rachel Jensen, is Jewish. And that comes up in the novel and her feelings 20 years after the war and what have you. And also comes up with the, spoiler alert, racism of Mike Smith.
You know the original character boots in this, don't you? Well, can I just first off say this is so much better than Unit ever was.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit embarrassment-y to say that, but it really, really, really is. But before we talk about antecedents, we should really talk about the characters because Rachel was, of course, written as Dr. Rachel Israel.
Yeah, yeah, it was really sort of pointed.
Yes, just in case you missed it the first time around. And, of course, Ratcliffe was Mr. Gummer. Do you know who Gummer was?
No.
I had to write it down myself. But he was Industry Secretary John Selwyn Gummer, and he loudly and formally resigned from the Church of England when they ordained Dawn French.
Right. As vicar. It is amazingly good, isn't it? Like, it's a massive, massive jump in quality. I didn't think season 24 was bad. But do you remember, Richard, they actually showed Remembrance of the Daleks with season 24.
They did. So we first saw it tagged after Dragonfire.
And we didn't expect it. And it was so good instantly, just so amazing. And it manages to constantly reference things. So it does Unit only well, you know. And you know, like, I loved Unit. Unit was, you know, the family, you know, back in the 1970s. It was sort of sweet and fun and it's comfort food. But it was always a sort of incompetent television army, whereas this is it sort of reimagined as something else. But this is absolutely packed full of references to previous Doctor Who without, you know, requiring you to have the Doctor Who monster book on hand.
Well, that's a bit of a relief, isn't it? Because it's entirely about contemporary Britain's take on the present and the past at the same time, just like Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, like Ben Aronovich said, one of his purposes in setting the story in 1963 is he didn't want to sugarcoat the past, and he wanted to point out that, okay, yeah, we defeated the Nazis, and one of ideas with the Daleks was Nazism. We also discussed that communism was an influence way back in episode one. But Ben Aronovich's perspective was, that doesn't mean we defeated racism, and that still existed in the 1960s. And he said to Andrew Cartmell, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And Cartmell said, yep, brilliant. And we get these dynamics between the characters. There's a deleted scene between Rachel, Allison and Mike where they're waiting for Ace to come out of the boarding house. Rachel and Allison kind of tease Mike that he fancies Ace. And Mike says, oh, not yet. Yeah, I know. But not yet, but I want to know more about her. And they say, what do you mean? And he says, well, I wouldn't want her to be foreign, would I?
No. And that's cut out, though, isn't it?
It's cut out. And I think it's a good thing it's cut out because it makes his bigotry a bit more nuanced. But at the same time, that is something someone would have said without shame in the 1960s.
It is. And it's nice that Mike's racism is so received from his mum. We need to talk about who his mum is too, because she crops up quite a bit. She's Mrs. Bidmead.
Yes.
Kathleen Bidmead. Now, she may not be our Mrs. Bidmead, but Bidmead did use her. So said, oh, God. Aronovich wasn't the only one looking at the early 60s, and certainly around this Bay of Pigs Kennedy assassination time. It just happened to be 25 years, but a lot of other contemporary fiction TV shows. Britain just generally, politically, socially was looking at this stuff. And as we've talked about Judge Dredd, and we've talked about Alan Moore, and we've talked about films of the time, Scandal comes out 2 years later about the Profumo affair with Ian McKellen as John Profumo, but not in a grey, lovely long grey curtain that was lying around. British culture was reanalyzing its post-war past, and finally, not as the golden age that our parents professed it had been. You know, and there were people like Nathan and I who were born a little while ago. I think that Mike's final funeral is actually a funeral for the blanket blinkered optimism of our parents' generation about this time. We're reappraising it in a truthful way, and you're seeing it all across TV and film at the time.
Mm. The novel is clearer about that because it deals with the characters' thoughts about the war. Like, think about the title, right? By this point, you have to have blank off the Daleks ever since. But you have Genesis, Destiny, and then it's R word of the Daleks, isn't it, after that?
Yeah,
Reticule.
Reticule of the Daleks.
Relocation.
Yeah, rehash of the Daleks. Yeah. Repetition of the Daleks.
Reticular vector gauge of the Daleks.
Yeah. But
recidivism of the
here, Daleks. Remembrances, because it ends with the funeral, it sort of makes sense. In the televised show, it doesn't really make sense as a title, apart from the fact that we're remembering the origins of Doctor Who as a show. But in the novel, what we're remembering is the war, like we're remembering the Second World War. And it's telling, you know, TV of the period is so post-war, isn't it? You know, even when you watch Fawlty Towers, you know, the war is still there in people's minds, and that's in the early 70s, you know. So it's an important thing in the lives of everyone, and that having the villains literally be Nazis is, or you know, fascists, British fascists, is fantastic. And for the novel, I think Aronovich invents Manisha, doesn't?
Yeah, doesn't yeah. He? Ace's friend Manisha, who yes. Will become a bigger part of her story next season and through to the new adventures.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got, you know, like her Asian friend whose flat is firebombed by sort of white supremacists, by skinheads in the 1980s. And, you know, that's why Ace takes that thing so seriously. And I love the scene where she finds the no coloured sign, because it's the kind of thing that Doctor Who hasn't had. You know, Doctor Who very rarely goes back to the recent past.
I don't remember Pertwee ever talking about it.
No.
Even that was quite an issue at the time. You know, that's the scene that J&T wanted to cut out.
Yeah, because it was too political, I imagine.
And yet when they took it to show it to Jonathan Powell, famously, Can't Mel tell us a story that Jonathan Powell took a phone call during the episode and so was turned away from the screen when that scene went on, and Andrew Cartmell did something that he found out later you just do not
You're not allowed to do it, yeah.
He grabbed the remote and said to Jonathan, I'm so sorry, I think it's very important you see this scene, rewound it and played it. And at the end of the episode, Jonathan Powell said, thank you for rewinding it. That scene is the point of the episode. She should have torn the sign up.
And then punched Mrs. Smith in the face.
It is such a powerful moment, especially because, you know, we've seen with Ace already, just in two stories, that she is the kind of person who will take actions before she considers them. Not all the time. But the thing is, she goes to challenge Mrs. Smith and then kind of just goes,
decides, yeah,
what's the point? You know, and I'm going out for some fresh air. Like, no, I can't be here with you. I would rather go fight a bunch of Daleks. And I think,
which is a proper British response.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is, actually. There's the thing of taking on the chin. It's also a very wartime thing of, you know, there was candor in non-disclosure. So, yeah, intimacy was expressed by what you didn't say.
Mm.
Or I shouldn't say intimacy, but understanding and compassion was conveyed by what isn't said.
As a kid watching that, I didn't know what coloured meant in that sense.
Mm.
So my parents had to explain it to me, and I think I said during a live tweet, I think that was my first knowledge of what racism was.
Mm.
We kind of said last season that Doctor Who is being... They're attempting to make Doctor Who on several levels again, and here they're more capturing the child, teenage, and older audience, I think, in this story than last year. And I think the whole story sends a really good message about racism, especially when Mike tries to justify his actions and uses the words, you know, you've got to keep everyone out to give your own people a chance. And Ace just rounds on him.
Yeah.
And, you know, makes it clear
five
that...
Five of them and rapidly.
Makes it clear that I could have liked you. We could have been something, but...
We could have been a contender. We could have been someone. But you just keep rattling on about Adam Faith. And his pretty blonde hair. I've got blonde hair. Who the frick's Adam Faith?
But that's what makes this so good, is that the Daleks are having a racial divide.
Racial divide?
A racial divide.
Called that as well. It's great, isn't it? Rachel Sewers Crisis. Rachel Panama Canal. No, we're not going there again.
What do you call it? What do you call a divisive article in a tabloid? Miranda Divide. Okay. The Daleks have a racial divide, and, you know, we
Katie
as humans
Hopkins
go,
for
oh,
the viewers and for the listeners in the UK.
Yeah. And we go, oh, we're so much better than Daleks. It's like, really? Are we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got a boarding house who doesn't allow, quote unquote, as the episode says, coloured people in there. But we also have a speaking black character in the form of Joseph Marcel in the cafe scene, which is another beautiful scene where the Doctor comes to get his cup of tea late at night, and the whole bit about...
It is a bit good, isn't it? Sugar. Yeah. I think that's a little secret name they have for each other. Anything to do with what appeared on screen.
Well, I quite like that because it gives the Doctor a little bit of interiority, because what does the Doctor think about, you know, overthrowing the Daleks or uniting Paradise Towers or doing whatever the hell it is he does in Dragonfire? Here he's planning to do something. He's planning to do something big. You know, he's planning to destroy Skaro, and it's all in his mind from the very beginning. And so we get a scene where he thinks about whether that's the right thing to do or not.
Yeah.
And the way that's told, we don't directly get to see what the Doctor's thinking, but we do get him to have that lovely conversation with the cafe owner. And I love that the cafe owner just – not the cafe owner, because he's that's Harry, isn't it?
Yeah.
The
that's,
guy
that's
working.
Harry Fowler. Do you know his first film was in 1947, Hue and Cry? And in the 50s, he played Paramore to Joan Collins. 1950s.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Oh, Joan Collins.
Had enough of that.
That's
in
why
the
they
war.
Called. That's why they called him. Yes, had another bear in the wall. That's why. That's why they just call him Harry, because you can't. You know, everyone knew him. No, there's lots of old faces in this.
But
Joseph Marcel plays John.
So I love the fact that he just dismisses the whole angst about it. He has no sort of particular philosophy. It's just best thing is to get on with it. And, you know, all of that agonizing gets kind of laughed at and thrown out the window. It's very cool. Mm.
And another thing I love about that scene is actually where they cut it. They cut it after that line of best thing is just to get on with it, which is the human reaction. And it's showcasing the human reaction versus the Doctor's alien reaction. The scene as originally shot then goes on that the little girl is standing outside looking at the Doctor, the girly Dalek controller. And she runs off and the Doctor says to John, look, I think you should get away for a few days. Things are likely to get nasty around here. And John's like, yeah, sure, whatever. The Doctor leaves a pound coin on the bench, goes outside. John picks up the coin and it says 1991. And the Doctor's looking at him through the window and gives him a nod and walks off. And I'm glad they didn't include that, because it changes the emphasis of the scene. Because the emphasis of the scene is the Doctor's interiority.
Mm.
But that end of the scene is the Doctor doing something quirky for the sake of being quirky.
Mm.
you know, when he's just given Ace a bag of proper currency so yes. she can blend in, he chucks in a 1991 £1 coin and then lectures Ace, oh, you know, if someone had found your tape deck, they could have reverse engineered it. Yeah, well, what about this?
Yeah, they could have reverse engineered the pound coin and we would have had pound coins, you know, decades before they ever existed.
It's post-decimal currency.
And then we would have never had that glorious scene of Carol Ann Ford.
No. Well, that's a reference. Again, it's one of these references is the fact that Ace...
Carol Ann Ford can't add up.
Okay, no, but Ace doesn't know about pre-decimal currency.
Decimal currency, yeah. Right.
And it's full of references, just overflowing with them. No, we're not just...
I think we like Nathan's reference from wherever it was 300 years ago when we first started this, that this is actually from the universe of the pilot rather than the broadcast series because of the dust jacket being missing.
That's right.
Revolution. I'm actually quite one with that one. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't look the same. A friend of the podcast, I believe it was Hua Pete, but I apologize if it wasn't and it's someone else, pointed out that maybe while she was traveling through time and space, Clara actually swapped the books around.
God, I'm so tired. Moffat is still, he'll always be here because he had to put his grubby little protuberances into everything, didn't he?
Into the invasion.
I think that's actually when it died for me. Moffat's era died for me when he just had to put himself in every moment of every story that's ever been. He couldn't just carry on. I think that is actually a good point. Doctor Who dies when it becomes self-referential. But in this case, it isn't because it's referencing what everybody else is doing, which is raise a glass. We've moved on from Germany. We're now in England. So we're talking about postmodernism.
Hooray! Or even to the point where we have Ace sitting down to watch the show that she's
within the show. Thank you. Absolutely there. And a cornerstone of this postmodernism thing, which really was what we were all talking about at the time, it's to analyze and reinvent the past with constant referencing and deflation of that past and then reinterpretation as to what is realistic. But the humour of the 80s came from that deflation, from that self-mocking. There were ads on British TV in grainy black and white of products from that time and then someone would come in colour and make a piss take on it. Or, do you remember that? And Ben Elton's entire career and therefore Rowan Atkinson's and therefore The Young Ones and therefore really all the stuff that we've got. Now, Sandy Toksvig would not exist if it wasn't for Remembrance of the Dark. She was in one, you know, when Rachel says, I think I'm going to be sick. That was very, very cruel. Yeah. Yes. Or to be Susan Carlman now. Speaking of, I tweeted her and told her that. She didn't respond, so she better look out.
She did mention being cast as the doctor.
She did. Yeah. She did, yes.
You know, I have wondered to myself because Ben Aronovich deliberately decided it was his choice to tie this story in with An Unearthly Child, the 1963 setting in Shoreditch, and Andrew Cartmell and John Nathan Turner were only too happy to because they did want this to be the 25th anniversary.
You really would
year.
Think it was a J&T idea, wouldn't you?
No, I mean, he supported it, but it was Aronovich's idea. But Aronovich then discovered that Attack of the Cybermen had been back to the junkyard as well. So he actually toned down some of the references. But it gets me wondering. Yeah, exactly. In Attack of the Cybermen, in episode 2, we have that like 3 or 4 minute info dump scene where the Doctor and Litton explain how the Cybermen came from Mondas, but then they went to Telos and then they invaded Earth. And then,
it's interesting. Richard.
And then all the,
I can't remember. Oh, I've seen it.
And then all the dinosaurs died and turned into oil. And then Charles started wearing all of Lady Di's dresses. I can't believe it. Anyway.
That's actually in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I must have slipped into a coma at that part of it.
But in this, we do get another info dump scene. It's where the Doctor has explained to Ace what the Hand of Omega is and why it came into being and who the two factions of Daleks are. And
it does sound like a lavatory product, doesn't it?
The Hand of Omega.
Time, yes.
A remote... a remote manipulator, indeed. But I was thinking to myself, what makes the Attack of the Cybermen scene... I quite like Attack of the Cybermen, but what makes that scene quite leaden but makes this one really electric? And I think it's two things. First of all, the stuff in Remembrance of the Daleks is all new information. The only thing that sort of comes back in there is other names, Rassilon and Omega, and then
Chunky.
The story. But then the story does new things with them in the postmodern way, whereas Attack of the Cybermen is just bringing us up to speed on something in the past.
You know what this really is? This was as if David Whittaker, Jody to his mates, had never retired. This is the Dalek Whittaker universe. Did you notice the planet reference, fan people? I had to write it down as well. Phoebus, the three-ringed planet who were in Scurrow's system, is in the Daleks Whittaker strip. And there's a little corner of it, pink, with three rings around it.
When Scurrow explodes.
Yeah, just in case you missed it. David Whittaker owns the universe. I actually think he has reincarnated as Jodie. I think that's what we're going to find out.
He's just acquired an extra T and taken up acting. Stop it.
So,
stop it there.
Gotten rid of his Thunderbird's eyebrows.
I think the Daleks are fantastic in this. I mean, they're really good. And I remember...
They're rattlingly good, aren't they?
Yeah, well, at the time, I remember wondering about the two factions because, of course, that's introduced in Revelation, which it manages to reference without being boring.
You see, I didn't have a copy of Revelation as a kid. Didn't matter. Really? I understood this.
Yeah. No, well, you don't need to.
Well,
but
the reason I've been rattling around so much in this podcast is that I'm now sporting an extra inflatable ball.
Well... yes, because, of course, the Daleks on this, as Sylv, is want to tell anyone who will listen. He was in The Hobbit, you know. But the Daleks in this, instead of having wheels, had three balls, which is why they sort of... But it was so they could get over the cobblestones easier, but it does rather make them look drunk.
Yeah, in the 60s, they used to put down a bit of fiberboard and just have them roll.
Well, they couldn't afford it anymore.
I remember the first time I watched it thinking that they'd got the continuity wrong because I had my copy of the Doctor Who Monster book on hand.
Which is amazing because it doesn't even cover the comic.
No,
here,
it didn't get that far. So Davros was picked up by normal coloured Daleks after creating a race of sort of white and gold
Super
Daleks.
Super Christmas Daleks.
Yeah, that suited the kind of the
Deco
look.
Loveliness.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that story? Can we have a little nerdy tech moment that Dalek tech from now on is Art Deco? The trans mat.
Yeah.
The game show set, as you mentioned.
Yeah. I think they look fantastic too. They don't have the light bulbs from a Morris Minor anymore and they don't have a sink plunger. You know, all of that stuff has been updated. They look really good and I think the colours look great. Mm. Yeah, and that wasn't a feature of those cream-coloured Daleks in Revelation.
But of course, you know, we are led to believe that Davros is leading the grey Daleks from his little motorcycle helmet chair.
How does that work? That he captured them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that the white Daleks, the cream Daleks, are being led by the Emperor. But then, shock horror.
The Emperor looks terrible, doesn't he? Like, it's really shockingly bad. Yeah. Someone once described it as
a
shrieking air ball, I seem to remember.
Sophie Aldred's had a glittering career since this, hasn't she, really? Putting on makeup and Chanel earrings and pouting about being upper middle class. Sorry, Soph, I loved you, but then on all the bloody DVD extras saying, well, she and I were terribly upper middle class. So it was lovely of them to give me a girly chum for every story. My lovely girly chum in this one was Alison Bleep, because no one can frickin' remember what she is or what she did. Who is she in this? I listen to Countermeasures, and she still wafts about in a number two prisoner scarf and, you know, tries to look useful. I think she makes the tea.
I don't
so
think Alison's very good, actually.
Brie Garson, is that who it is?
Karen Gledhill.
She's charming.
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't do anything.
She has a couple of great lines, and one of them is when Mike clobbers that pretty ginger soldier.
Oh, hello. And, where are we going with this then?
And Rachel says to Alison, is he all right? And Alison responds, I don't know, I'm a physicist.
I think that's a dig at Liz Shaw, who just conveniently becomes a medical doctor for no reason at some point in Inferno.
I would like to think they thought that way.
But the Brigadier does say that Liz has degrees in half a dozen other subjects.
How? We've covered this. She only looks 28. Any doctorate takes at least 4 years.
Well, remember, her husband is the master, so he absorbs life energy and gives it to her.
That'd be an interesting take on breakfast table conversation, wouldn't it? What have you got for me to absorb this morning, Dave? This Sarah Sutton's career.
God, that's like the Valiard absorbing the Doctor's future lines, isn't it? I think part of what makes this story work so well and what makes this season work so well, and it's what makes the continuity work so well, is Sylvester's insistence that Sophie's character as Ace gets more to do. And it was something that Andrew Cartmell was very passionate about as well, because as much as he thought too much has been revealed about the Doctor, as much as he thought the Doctor is not a positive influence on stories, which is something we complained about during Colin's era, he also thought that the Companion, you know, if the Doctor is being pushed down in the order of the story, the Companion gets pushed down with him. So bring them both up together at the same time. So in that scene where the Doctor's explaining the Hand of Omega, rather than Ace just saying, "What is it, Doctor? Who's Omega, Doctor? What's this? What's that?" she asks questions like, so it manipulates stars. You know, she asks for clarification using information. And when the Doctor slips up and says, "Didn't we have trouble with the prototype?" she is immediately on it.
Yes, we.
And it'll come back again in Silver Nemesis as well.
You know,
Sutek is very talkative today.
Everyone's got something to say about this story.
I really like that hilarious response where the Doctor says it's called the Hand of Omega because Time Lords have an infinite capacity for pretension.
Much
like this podcast. She just says, "Yeah, I've noticed that," which I just think is wonderful.
And,
that
you know,
wanker,
she uses the Andy Tank rocket on the Dalek. And the Doctor's like, "You destroyed it." And she's like, "I aim for the eyepiece."
Gorgeous, isn't it? It's great, like, lines.
Okay, yeah, aim for the eyepiece with a handgun. It doesn't particularly matter when you use an anti-tank rocket.
That actually is an ATR.
Yeah.
And she was, and that is a powder burn on the back wall.
Yeah,
she did get the recoil in the shoulder.
You
can tell why every little girl of a certain inclination and age just thought,
I've done it frame.
Boys too.
I've done that frame by frame, and you see the back blast make the burn mark. She also did the jump through the window herself.
No, she didn't. That was Tip Tipping's wife. But she did all the shots before and she wanted to, but it was the one thing they would not let her do.
Okay, because that's right. Yeah, she does. Sorry,
being a girl, she'll sprain her ankle, and actually, she does that during the shoot.
Yeah, so she jumps towards the window. They use the other shot with the stunt woman going through the window, but she then does crash into the wall, does the running through the corridor, etc., etc. And Tip Tipping kind of said to her, "Okay," after that take was done, he took her by the arm, took her to a chair, sat her down, and he said, "Now you sit here." And she's like, "Why?" And he said, "You just sit here." And she says, you know, a few minutes later, "I was essentially in shock."
Mm.
And he said, "Look, that happens even to experienced stunt people. And I knew it was going to happen." So
pushy cows like you taking jobs away from proper workers. Yes.
Well, that will eventually see the end of Tip Tipping on the show, won't it? But we're getting ahead of ourselves. No, not Sophie Aldred, but a stuntman situation.
Yeah, but he didn't die in Doctor Who.
No.
Just everyone else's career.
Yeah, a couple of years later.
He's a bit lovely too. He's the lad that brings in Mike, escorts Mike. Forget about Tommy. He's really got a bit of a Jesus fixation. He dies 3 or 4 times in this show. You see him quite clearly in the junkyard.
Yeah.
You see him quite clearly corralling the troops. And of course, he'd been in the SAS. He got all that precision happening. And the big thing in fan crap at the time was that extra at the end was out of sync. And they said, no, that's an homage to Clive Dunn in Dad's Army.
Oh, right. Was it?
Bloody fans.
No. But it works. It works because is this the best Dalek story in Doctor Who so far?
No. I think Power of the Daleks is the best Doctor Who story.
It's up
the
there,
best
though.
Dalek story. It is very, very good, though. And we haven't had a good Dalek story maybe since Genesis.
And you're right, because at the time we thought it was, but no one had seen Power since the times.
You know what? It knocks spots off the other Davros stories, mainly because Davros is in it so much. And
he's in a roll-on, yes.
That's not a slight against Terry Malloy. I think Terry Malloy is
brilliant. Lovely. I'd like a saucy calendar of him floating in a bathtub of rice pudding.
But I think
in the mask, obviously.
You know, we've discussed before that Terry Nation was of the opinion that he had to create Davros because Daleks can't deliver dialogue for sustained periods of time. And
what?
We've discussed
that. Whittaker's shown that that's not necessarily the case.
Well, so is Russell as well. I mean, it was a long time before Davros is reintroduced. There are plenty of Dalek stories.
Mm.
And they're fine. You know, you just have to write for them.
Like Nick Priggs has the range.
He does. Well,
Duchassi.
He does. No, quite literally has the range.
But the thing is, Terry Nation, of course, still had vetting rights on scripts at this point.
Yes.
Originally, Ben Aronovich discussed not using Davros at all, and JNT said to him, no, he has to be in there somewhere because otherwise we won't get it past Terry. And even then, when Terry got the scripts...
Makes no sense to me at all, but yeah, go on.
Even then, when Terry got the scripts and Davros was only revealed, like, in the last 10 minutes, Terry did complain. He said, Davros should be in it more, Davros should be in it more. And John Nathan Turner pointed out, yes, but you see, this Dalek controller that we've got on the other side is going to look like Davros from behind. So everyone's going to think Davros is on the side of the Black Daleks until it's revealed to be the little girl, and then we reveal Davros. And at that point, Terry Nation was happy because Davros would be felt, as it were, throughout the story without actually being in it. I think this is a good time, though, to talk about Yasmin Brakes as the girl.
One of many little girls in the Sylvester McCoy era, one of Andrew Cartmell's little girls. The last one, Stella, was not particularly successful.
Dreadful.
And, yeah, like really terrible, and we couldn't work out why she was even in it.
They owe a lot to the 1962 film we've already addressed, The Bad Seed, which is one of John Waters' greatest favourite films of all time, which has a little girl exactly like Yasmin Brakes who knocks about in some poor bloke's nicked bike helmet. with a torch on the end of it. Yeah, well, you know she's got the bicycle helmet. over the incontinence chair.
We're kind of used to children being in Doctor Who now, but they weren't really in it very much at all in the classic series.
For good reason.
I mean, yeah, I'm thinking Reign of Terror had a child.
Yeah.
And he's good.
Yeah.
Probably. Debbie Watling, lovely our Debbie Watling, played a child. She was only meant to be a child.
Yeah.
As we record today, Debbie passed away yesterday.
Yeah.
Which is very sad.
We'd met her at a convention.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
She was lovely.
Entirely encased in a cylinder of smoke, just like the hand of Omega was nicking her at that very moment.
Don't forget gin. But
I do like a woman who likes a gin, as Debbie said.
A segue to say, the last time I met Debbie, because, of course, met her in 2005, we had a convention with her.
Yes, and Fraser.
Yep. Mm-hmm. A few years later in the UK, I met her at a convention again, and she said to me in the bar, I know you! And I said, yes, but I have less hair now. But then I met her again a few years ago at another convention here where I was dressed like Daphne Ashbrook in the telly movie, if we remember.
We dated.
And Debbie just looked at me and said, what is it you're wearing? And I pointed at Daphne and said, you see, I like dressing up as Doctor Who Girl, so I'm dressed up as her. And so the last words Debbie Watling ever spoke to me were, oh, darling, I thought you were one of the normal ones.
I was hoping she was going to say, when are you going to do me?
yes. But that is how I shall remember her. Thinking I was normal.
In such an enclosed petri dish of fandom, she would look for a norm.
But sinister children in the 80s were the bread and butter of horror films, you know. Yes. Children doing horrible things. Mm. And, you know, in the 60s we'd had Village of the Damned, Children of the Damned.
Macaulay Culkin.
Yes, that's right. But I think she does an incredible job.
And
I think her
the Olsen twins.
if I were to criticize Yasmin Brakes for something, it would be she's given a few lines and they're not particularly great, but at the same time she's Dalek controlled, so things like time controller activated. It's just a little bit stagey, but when she's silent and just looking around and looking at things, she's incredibly sinister.
Well, I think she's just channeling later 18th season Lala Ward, isn't she? It's as if Tom Baker is constantly just off camera. Because that whole slit your sinners look at you.
You know what? I kind of wish all of her dialogue...
Probably was. That's why she was giving him eyes. Because, you know, women tended to do that to Tom at that period of his life.
I kind of wish all of her dialogue had been in the nursery rhyme hopscotch tune that she sings, because of course
that wouldn't have been irritating at all. No.
But that had been made sinister at the time by the Freddy Krueger films.
Yes. No, it would have been really good.
Yeah.
And in iambic pentameter, obviously.
<That's right. laughs> But, you know, that is a minor criticism of a really good use of
a
child character.
She's only 12, you bastard.
I'm a Doctor Who fan. I have to find something to criticize. We've already criticized the Daleks' testicles.
Well, you may say that. I'm finding them extremely comfortable.
And buoyant.
Buoyantly so.
I think you'd look really good in that costume. She is even cosplaying Lala in France. I mean, come on.
Oh, dear.
Selfness. And as Rachel is cosplaying, just take a moment, Barbara.
Yes.
Barbara. Oh, that is so deliberate and so wonderful.
The cardigan. Mm. You feel like unraveling it.
Great moments. She's in the back of the transit van, which, by the way, that Bedford van is not a 1963 model for the fanboys out there. It's a later one, the black one with the
yes,
the red prop on the top. When she says, "Group captain, I've got a man."
Even that's really good. You know,
it's fabulous. I love it so much. It moves at such a pace.
Yeah, they're starting to do things on location which are really good. There's a lot of stuff on location.
People look like they're enjoying themselves.
Yeah. There's action. Like, there's proper action with stuff exploding and things.
Wordgasm peril.
Yes.
Time Incorporated. I think everyone's pretended that never happened.
Including me. And I spent like 2 weeks editing it. You know, even when we do have word peril, like when the Doctor says the Daleks have weapons capable of cracking this planet open like an egg.
No, that works.
That works because we have seen their firepower.
And it's 1963 and there's a Cold War on.
Yeah,
we've just had the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
Well, hence that opening, you know, the cold open, which so rarely happens in Doctor Who. Mm. Is it the second one after Castrovalva?
It's only the third time.
Five Doctors had a cold open as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's a bit harsh on Billy. He was dead. Do you know that was going to be her madge? It was going to be the Queen in that thing. And they asked her, they approached the palace. And they said, You cannot soundbite the Queen, Her Majesty, but you can have Prince Philip. So there's a bit of Prince Philip in there.
Yeah.
As many a showgirl has attested.
Yeah, I think that's a bloody wonderful opening shot as well. It's weird that it ends in a freeze frame, but aside from that.
My father was at a party in 1968 with Shirley Bassey where she did something I cannot mention on this podcast, but she was also flirting with him because he was attractive in his day, and that she'd had a fling with Prince Philip. She was very strong about suggesting that to the several gentlemen at the time. She was having a fling with Prince Philip at the time, 68. So she's in this and all.
Hey,
yes. You're going to be executed for treason when this podcast goes out.
I don't think it's Terry Molloy.
Prince Philip without makeup.
No, it's Shirley Bassey.
Daleks are forever. I will teach you the folly of your words.
Actually, I think that might catch on.
Jodie Whittaker is the Doctor. Shirley Bassey is Davros.
Can you imagine? I think every single person in the new show should be a lady type.
The future old girl?
Like a Zygon inversion.
Yeah.
You know what?
I'd like to see Oswald come in as the companion for a little while.
Yeah.
A bit charming. But Chibnall won't do that because it wasn't his idea.
No. I think it's time to move away from all of the Moffat paraphernalia, really.
Although, I think it would be a great time to bring Ace back. School reunion
style.
She's
up in
just one
class.
Story.
She said that on the DVD. I'm up a meal car sign.
Not a lot of people know that.
I would just like to say one more thing before we go, because we mentioned the rest of the primary guest cast. We should really mention Simon Williams as the Brigadier we never had.
Isn't he a bit lovely?
Gilmore.
Were you always downstairs looking at him upstairs, or were you upstairs looking at him downstairs? I never bloody watched it. It looks frizzingly boring, although Lala Ward was in it.
And of course, Jean Marsh.
Oh, no, that's Duchess of Duke Street. Yeah. Jean Marsh was...
Yes, that's right.
...was actually fingering from the, you know, with a Ian McKellen cape on and a pointy hat.
Upstairs, downstairs at the Duchess of Duke Street with the House of Idiot next door. Yeah.
You know that's what this was?
The House of Idiot?
No, it was Battlefield. This Battlefield is the story he pitched, but they went, oh, no, because we've actually got a show that's a bit like that, so you should do this one, which turns out to be exactly like another one called Silver Nemesis that was coming later in the season.
And, of course, the working title for this one was Nemesis of the Doctor.
Yeah.
Which is
also a comic strip in the Doctor Who Monthly.
Well, that's where the title then
I think we're going to implode inside our own fandom like a tiny neutron star, aren't we?
You know, earlier where you said that...
Something annoying, yes.
Yes, you said that Moffat had... We'll probably have cut it out, but...
I do that this week. Everything. I take up an hour and they only need 5 minutes.
Where you said that that Stephen Moffat had sort of colonized the whole show by inserting Clara into every scene. Aronovich does this to the Doctor because when the Doctor's in London in 1963, he's not a Time Lord, he's not from the planet Gallifrey, he's not hiding the hand of Omega somewhere, you know, he's a mysterious old man from a distant planet, and this is the show kind of trying to rope him back in and make him be what the Doctor ended up being.
Right. Is this the rise of the Moffs? This is the seed, the kernel, which it all blooms.
It's the show going back and
it is, isn't it?
Changing its own past.
In a way that Attack of the Cybermen didn't do at all.
No, it was just too busy giving David Banks opportunities to write sort of leaden, you know, compendiums of drawings of various Cybermen designs.
I do think it's... Episode one is Colin Baker's greatest moment as the Doctor. I think Attack of the Cybermen episode one is just hilarious for Colin.
Running
you
around.
You asked me to say something nice last time. About No, but I mean, he really is. Yeah. If it had stayed like that, I wouldn't have minded. Yeah,
yeah, they're lovely together in it.
Biffo's policeman. Sad lacking of Brian Blessed in the episode. But
No, I quite like him in that too. I think Attack of the Cybermen is terrible. It's terrific.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's another example of why Remembrance works better than Attack of the Cybermen.
Because it's not terrible.
Well, because, yes, it does retcon, but it retcons in a way that doesn't necessarily contradict what we knew before. So even though you sort of look at the First Doctor and you go, he's not a man with a mission, no, but he could be a man with a dangerous machine on board that he's trying to keep out of alien hands, especially with his lecture to Susan about how these savages will never understand our technology. So, you know, okay, why bury it in their graveyard? But the point
Harold
is...
Harold Ford's career.
It's
another Jeffrey Beavers moment to Harry, isn't it? Here, my darling, Carol Ann. You know why this works? All that stuff's just for us. It works because it talks about us now and us back then and us at whatever age, sitting there, when our parents were doing the groove in 62, 63, saying, your parents were wrong, they weren't cool, they were actually like this. And we all went, yeah.
And it's got a proper story and about Daleks shooting each other. You know, like, so it's very clear.
Because it's got your guns, as you put it, it's got your frocks, and it's got a bit of truthiness as well.
Yeah.
Casual viewers. If the BBC had, and they did promote this, and it didn't do that badly, did it?
No. This got 5 million.
And they're going to get even more later in the season. If they just chose to promote, they actually ended up doing quite well. They just tended to ignore it.
Yeah, average ratings for this are around 5.4, 5.5. Audience Appreciation Index around the 70s.
Which is extraordinary. We haven't had that for a while. In fact, I don't think we've had that for, since Revelation.
Mm. And this is around the time it was up against Coronation Street. Yeah. Imagine if they put it on Saturday night. Those ratings would have gone up by at least a million, which would have been what Peter was getting at the end and Colin was getting in his first season, because Colin's ratings in his first season were respectable.
Yeah.
So, the BBC is trying to kill it, and JNT and Andrew Cartmell are saying, fine, we're going to make the best damn show we can.
This is the season where everyone cares a lot and it will show.
Mm.
Stay tuned, someone used to say.
Well, dear listener, that's all the time we have for Remembrance of the Daleks as part of Australia's Remembrance of the Daleks podcast month. Do come back next week for the Happiness Patrol. In the meantime, in the show notes for this episode, you can vote for your choice of a Colin Baker story commentary, and we have four stories nominated. Todd has nominated The Mark of the Rani. Richard has nominated Revelation of the Daleks. I am nominating The Mysterious Planet, a.k.a. Trial of a Time Lord, Episodes 1 to 4, and Nathan has nominated Terror of the Vervoids, a.k.a. Trial of a Time Lord, 9 to 12. So, sorry, folks, you won't get us to watch Time Lash. Meanwhile, over on Bondfinger, we are about to get three quarters of the way through the Pierce Brosnan era of James Bond. Next week, we'll be releasing our commentary for The World Is Not Enough. So do check that out on bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at BondfingerCast on Twitter. We, of course, are flightthroughentirety.sexy, flightthroughentirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Until next time, don't bloody throw us in a lake, because you better believe there'll be consequences. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
It's got three settings. Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brennan Jones, and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. Logo designed by Anthony Wells. This episode, Daleks Are Forever, was recorded on the 22nd of July, 2017. The next episode will be released on August 6th. We dedicate this episode to the memory of Deborah Watling, who played Victoria in Doctor Who. She sleeps in our mind, but we won't forget.
I think I've now officially run out of closing credits jokes.
Base them on a line from the episode. That's what I always do.
Okay.
Or just steal them from Stephen Benofsky, since he's stolen our entire format and had a successful tagline.
Yeah, no, I hate talented, attractive people.
If I knew some, I'd probably be all right with the tagline.
So you start off by slagging off Stephen Buzanovsky and then just slag off all of our listeners by saying you don't know any attractive people. Hooray!
We have very attractive listeners, I think. That's right.